It's never just me. It's me and Jamie O'Reilly and Bob Chirito and John Devins. And we're talking about the new season of concerts at the Castle. They take place at Givens Castle, 103rd and South Longwood. In an effort, they're concerts by some of Chicago's best performers, all in the cause of helping. Givens Castle is not a brand new building. It is an older building that needs help. Sort of not so much.
Any new castles?
I don't know. Some idiot millionaire, bond trader has probably built a new castle in Scotland or something. Yeah, but there are new castles. I bet there are because, oh, well, I gave all my money to this thing. What should I do with the rest of my money? Build a castle. There, that's a good idea. You know, it's a good thing I don't sit around with billionaire bond traders. It's to help the castle. It's to help the castle, and it's an ongoing series that John has been doing for, you know, a little more than 2 years. You have the Sons of the Never Wrong. The Blossom Boys get into this with flowers. You then have Jamie O'Reilly in February. You just were listening to Jamie. If you just tuned in, you missed Jamie singing live on air. Then you have the Sons of the Never Wrong. John Williams and Dennis Cahill, Michael Smith and Ann Hills. This is a great. You've done this, Larry Gray and John Mulder. I know the crowds must love it, and you can only seat something in the neighborhood of 100, 120 in there. What do the performers think of performing in there, John?
Oh, they love it.
Jamie, is that true?
Oh, we had a great time. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a wonderful venue.
Yeah, I've been
really cool.
Yeah, and it is so worth seeing. They used to have a nice little restaurant like Cafe 103.
Yeah,
did that go away?
Yeah,
it's too bad. I mean, there are enough restaurants around there you could make a whole evening of it. But I'll keep you up to date on this thing. Hear somebody, right?
Well, we're going to hear John Williams and Dennis Cahill. These are two masters of Irish and Celtic music, and they're going to do a set of reels.
You can hear them before. It's John Williams and Dennis Cahill, January 9th. You have to wait till February 1st to see Jamie O'Reilly at the Castle, though you can see her this coming Wednesday at a very, very, very decent saloon restaurant called Chief O'Neill's, and then you will see her do The show is called In Old Chicago, Stories and Songs of a Beloved City. You two guys, without you, Chicago would be bereft.
Without you,
you
want to
look
Chicago
that word up, too?
I know.
You know that word.
I know that word.
Oh, God, yes, thank God. You're. Yes. You too, Jamie.
Well, a little thing about Chief O'Neill's is that it's a little bit like a museum.
Oh, no question.
They've collected artifacts from the families, and Chief O'Neill's history itself is fascinating because he was a police chief, and he was the fellow who wrote down a lot of those jigs and reels that we get to hear, even though he was a Chicago guy.
1001.
Jigs and reels. Yeah. And so then they open this club because it's run by musicians, Brendan and Siobhan, and they really are welcoming to the community. But what I like about the space, when you talk about sound similarly to the castle, is when you get a live room that has beautiful wood, right, John?
Right.
It really makes a difference for the singer. You want your sound system to just supplement the room and not take over the room like a rock club. And in both cases, you know, we're in real good hands with the sound, Chief O'Neill's and the castle, I'd say.
Well, I'm excited about the castle series. Are you surprised at all, John, that it's been as durable and successful as it's been? I mean, because you started this like on a wing. I think, you know,
I was pleasantly surprised when World Folk Music Company was such a success with these concerts.
Yeah.
I wasn't too surprised.
Oh, you're right.
With the cast.
You're right.
We've been very successful with everyone.
Are tickets sold in advance, or is it at the
tickets are sold on our website, concerts at the castle.
Yes. Where I'm only laughing because it was forever that John didn't. I go, God, you've got to have a website, man. These people can't keep calling me at work, though I will help sell tickets that way. John,
I've been giving out your phone number. So
I don't care, obviously. John, it's always good to see you. Jamie, I adore you. And Jamie O'Reilly Wednesday. And Jamie O'Reilly's got a great website, jamieoreilly.com.
Thank you, buddy.
We'll be back after a few minutes with a very talented reporter who is now an author. And that is a tough thing to do these days, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It is a pleasure to read the byline of John Seidel in the Chicago Sun-Times, because I do read the Chicago Sun-Times every day, as I read Block Club Chicago, where you see, hey, Bob Chirita, you call a byline when it's online?
Sure.
Do you? John Seidel, welcome to the show, and congratulations on Second City Sinners, a true crime from historic Chicago's deadly streets. And one of the great things about the book, and there are many great things about the book, is it dips into the archives of what I will ever consider the greatest paper in the history of Chicago, the Chicago Daily News. Bob, tell the story. When I invited Bob to come in and sort of be an informal co-host, without even asking me, Rick, can you give me money to buy the book? He went out and bought the book. What happened when you went out and bought the book?
Well, I went to Barnes & Noble just because it was the closest to where I was, and there's not many bookstores around anymore.
That's true.
And I went in, and I was looking for it, and then I finally had to ask for help. And the clerk told me, oh, he knew it right away. He said, oh, that's a hot book. He goes, we sold our last two copies last night. And so I had to go find it at another Barnes & Noble.
Isn't that nice to hear, John?
It's incredible to hear, and I really appreciate that. I appreciate the kind words. And
this is your first book.
Yeah.
The way this came about, let's see, you write this in the back, I think, this book began with an email from an editor at Lyons Press. Detail that for me, because, Bob, you know, too, this is the most screwed-up publishing environment that I've ever encountered. It hasn't been this bad in 20 years. So what was that email about?
Yeah, no, I was really, really lucky the way that this happened. Steph Scott, my editor at Lyons, it was exactly what I said. I just got an email out of the blue. I remember being on the train on the way home. I got this email about a potential book. And I don't even think I replied right away. I think I went home and made a comment to my wife about it. And, you know, it was December. It was the holidays. There was a lot going on.
Sure.
But I think a couple days later, I got back and started asking a few more questions. And I, you know, obviously I've written about a lot of crime in the city. I thought they were interested more in current events.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And they said that they were more interested in history.
Had they noticed your stories? Had they been reading your coverage of federal courts and crime in Chicago?
Yeah, I think that they had... they had picked up on a couple of stories. And, you know, it's as I've told some people, it's never what you pour your heart and soul
yeah,
into.
Right, right.
You know, I
and you
mean,
think they say, well, it was a story about so-and-so, and you go, man, that was terrible. I blew it on them.
You know, but, I mean, there were little bits and pieces that they, there was something in the writing that apparently stuck with them. And
that's pretty flattering. I think that's pretty flattering. Did you then have to massage the idea of the book? Because the book, of course, it has to include some of the main usual suspects that would be in a book like this. You've got to have Capone in here. You've got to have Dillinger in here. You've got to have H.H. Holmes in here. You've got to have, who else, Bob Chirino? Who else would you include in a book like
oh,
that?
The Bobby Franks murder.
Yeah, yeah. So what parameters did they give you?
Mostly time frame. You know, they only wanted to go so close to current times. You know, the book goes to 1966.
Yeah.
With Speck.
Yeah. And from there, they really, I mean, there was some back and forth, whether it should be more mob focused or just general crime. The idea for really the theme of the Daily News came from, you know, the process. You know, I thought obviously about going to the Sun-Times and seeing what kind of access they would give me, and they were very kind. They opened the library right up to me.
Yeah.
I eventually went back to them and said, you know, I'm spending all this time going through the Daily News. It's like, you know, I just want to make that kind of a sub-theme through the book that this is kind of how the Daily News told these stories.
Well, I think that's a wise. What do you think about that, Bob?
Yeah,
I mean, it's a wise, wonderful decision.
Convince you to write the book, or I mean, did you ask them like why now? Why this book?
Yeah, there were a lot of questions, and there was a lot of back and forth. And I don't think it was until like February of 2018 that we really like, you know, signed the deal.
Well, what was the thing that convinced you to do it?
Well, it was both, you know, honestly, looking into Lyons a little bit, making sure that. You know, there was nothing I should be worried about there, and I should say they've been great to work with, but also just my ability to do it, right? I mean, so I cover federal courts
right.
at the Sun Times. We're pretty busy, and I'll admit, I mean, there were times when I was thinking about not going down this road because it's just so much.
It's a ton of work.
I mean,
you got this done in like a year.
About a year and a half if you add in revisions. Or
that's quick. You write in the fine preface, Frank Main, a terrific reporter, writes a very lovely foreword to the book. Yes. But in the preface you write, reading these stories taught me a great deal, not just about Chicago's bloody past, but about its newspapers and the generations of journalists who hustled to tell a story still unfolding after almost two centuries. Would you have called yourself a historian? Had you read any of these, you know, the stories about the Bobby Franks murder, Leopold and Loeb trial? Were you a student of history? Because I have to think, I think, I'm going to make my
sure.
pronouncement, that one of the great attractions of the book is I can sense your enthusiasm about the research of the book. You bring a real freshness to this. Even, do you agree, Bob?
Yeah, there was a lot of stories that I thought I knew, and there was a lot of new stuff about those stories that I learned. So it was great.
I really appreciate it. And no, I mean, to your first question, as far as do I consider myself a historian, I've never used the label historian to myself. But I will say that I've always been fascinated about learning about the history of my place, right? You know, like my house is 80 years old. I know who's lived there. I've looked them up.
Where are you from originally?
Originally, I'm from Pennsylvania.
How did you wind up in Chicago? Give me the quick...
So my parents were musicians. My dad was a professor. And we kind of bounced around from universities, different places around the Midwest. I spent most of my youth growing up in Indiana, though. We got there when I was about 10. And but I kind of got into journalism when I was around 14. And Chicago's just such a great
town. Yeah, of course. No, there's no arguing the magnet that Chicago would
sure. And exert. I, you know, I have to say, I met my wife down in Indiana, but she had grown up here too, and so there was that attraction as well. But that's all of that just kind of made Chicago the obvious place that I wanted to go to.
When did you start at the Sun Times?
Started at the Sun Times in 2012.
Before that,
I worked for some of their sister suburban papers, mostly at the Post Tribune, covering Gary City Hall in Northwest Indiana.
You know, the funny thing is, you guys are young, and I've told this to Bob a million times. If this were 20 years ago, I'd know you from drinking at various places around town. It was a much more the offices were closer too. It was a much closer knit. But it's a real pleasure to meet you and a pleasure to read you. The archives were in the form of news clippings, correct?
It was a mix. I mean, there was a lot of microfiche. There's a lot of that, but also I got to spend a couple days out in we've got a warehouse in the suburbs where we have all of the old files.
Nothing quite like that, is there?
There's nothing like that. And just fascinating the way that work was done, right? It's all filed by name. So somebody was going through the
paper. Kind of astonishing when you think about it. Yeah, with every name. If a story had eight names, this was going in eight different little envelopes. There's a real excitement in that. Mm-hmm. We got to take a commercial break and get some news, and then we will devote the last half hour of this program to this book. We'll talk about some of the famous cases, but some of the non-famous cases are equally exciting. And didn't you think, Bob?
Yeah, definitely. I have a bunch of questions.
I'm going to make you pick your favorite ones. So spend this news time picking that. So we will back in a few minutes. The pleasant company I'm in is John Seidel, a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, covering the federal courts and the nonsense that goes on there, and Bob Chirito, who writes a lot for Black Up Chicago and a lot of other sites and magazines. We're talking about John's first recently published book, Second City Sinners, True Crime from the Historic Chicago's Deadly Streets. He writes in here, and you should know this, this book is not based exclusively on yellowed newspaper clippings, though. To varying degree, I used historical records to fill gaps and bring out details that may not have fit into newspaper columns. You selected, I'm going to just jump into this. I found your section on the Black Hand, though I knew a great deal about it. Very well done.
Thank you.
You write the phenomenon, organized crime, the phenomenon has long plagued Chicago, but it didn't begin with Al Capone. It certainly didn't. Talk about the Black Hand for a while, John.
Yeah, the Black Hand was it was an organization that I learned about it for researching the book.
Yeah.
And it was an early priority of the FBI here in the city, and it was described as a kind of shadowy group. They would send, they would extort people through the mail, send letters demanding money, and if you didn't send the money, they were going to blow up your house or they were going to blow up your store. And it really did become a little bit of a media phenomenon, and there would be cases identified as Black Hand crime. Now, whether or not this was one massive organization or just a few people sending nasty letters through the mail, it became a little bit of a debate, and I'm sure the media pushed it, but that was really kind of what it was about. And there was a series, I mean, when you read through the Daily News in the early 20th century, you'll just see story after story about Black Hand strikes again, or the federal government coming down and declaring war with the Black Hand.
Yeah. What do you think, Bob?
Yeah, I thought it was a great chapter because, like you said, you always hear about Capone, and then you hear about Accardo and Giancana, but you don't hear about the stuff way back.
Well, the origins of it, and I think that's a wonderful chapter, as is Murderous Row. I know about this because I had the Tribune put the arm on me to contribute some kind of chapter to a book the Tribune is coming out with about Murderous Row, featuring a lot of archives from the Tribune.
Looking forward to that.
Did you know anything about these ladies before you dipped into that research?
A little bit. I was aware. I was aware that those characters were based on real people.
Yeah.
But again, no, this was, I became much more familiar with them through researching it. And, you know, I will say that researching that, one little piece of research that I did outside of the Daily News, I was surprised at the records that the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office had available, including the victim of Belva Gartner, who was the inspiration for Velma Kelly.
Yeah.
I was able to read the transcripts from the inquest after that happened, which was really fascinating.
Yeah, one thing does always, and you guys have been reporters for a long time, lead to another. Mm-hmm. When you would have to and necessarily tackle something that had been written about extensively, I'm thinking specifically about H.H. Holmes, Devil in White City, Al Capone, 100 books, sure. Leopold and Loeb, Compulsion, and many books and many films. How did you go about that? I just want to talk about the sort of challenges of absorbing previous material mm-hmm. and then trying to give it, and you do, you give it a real exciting edge. Each one of those things, I thought to myself, okay, I can skim this, but I did not.
Thank
Bob,
you.
What did you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's the toughest thing as a writer for any story that's highly covered.
Sure.
It's kind of like you're looking for the grave digger, like Breslin did with Kennedy. And I think you pulled it off. Did you avoid any research or prior work so it wasn't an influence? Or
not so much avoid. Of course, I had about a year to put this book together, so there were time limits, of course.
As a new author, you must realize that is a very, very short time. You're talking about,
yeah,
I
no,
swear,
right.
John,
yeah.
You're talking about it as if, oh, I had a whole year to do this. I mean, there are other writers who would strangle you out.
Sorry.
Not me and Bob.
But I was just excited about it because it gave me a shot at writing about some of it.
Yeah.
You mentioned Leopold and Loeb.
Sure.
And I was also, again, just inspired and tried to let myself be guided by the newspaper archives, by the archives of the Daily News. And what did they emphasize? And just bringing out some of the writing of theirs, and Leopold and Loeb, the Daily News's role in solving
Franks,
as well as the St. Valentine's Day massacre, just bringing out how the Daily News covered that, which I there's just great writing in those archives that I'd hate to think is just lost forever.
I did notice a lot of colorfulness that maybe's not around right now. With the newspapers and also with the characters who they wrote about. I mean, there's a quote from H.H. Holmes talking about a murder, and he said, I think I'll swing for that.
Yeah.
And most people probably today won't even catch the reference to
sure.
talking about swinging.
Hanging. What do you both think? Do you feel constrained by newspaper work? By newspaper writing work, I know we all are happy to have jobs in newspapers, but the kind of newspapers remain now is sort of politically correct in a fashion that doesn't suit the world in which we live, I believe. The .... for a word everybody knows, and the sort of colorful nature of writing. Not that it doesn't exist in some places. I mean, when we cover things in. As you know now, it was a livelier, and I think vastly more entertaining style. The old days when there were 8 papers, and the competition was intense, too.
Yeah, sure it was. And the competition it's probably why. I mean, I like to think that there's a little bit of a strain left of it in the writing. I mean, we certainly try and write interesting stories at the Sun-Times, accurate stories, but interesting stories. And I think the same at the Tribune. But certainly, you got to be careful. You got to be careful with everything that you put in there.
That's one point. You too, Bob?
Yeah, and I think it goes back to, a lot of times nowadays, somebody would just swear instead of using more colorful language like they did in the past in some of these stories that are in the book.
Well, and the other thing is that sometimes the writers just got to sit at a typewriter and write their story without having to punch it into a phone first.
And, who knows how much of those quotes back in the 30s
and
40s
real.
Were real.
Well,
yeah, I'm suspicious of some these days. We got to take a break, and we'll come back and talk about. I want to talk about Dillinger, because you do a wonderful job with Dillinger, and the book does end with the scariest guy, Richard Speck, because I was only 14. I thought he was coming to kill me. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You will see the name John Seidel on stories in the Sun-Times, however you absorb the Sun-Times, in print or online. And you will also, if you walk in a bookstore, find that name affixed to a book called Second City Sinners, True Crime from Historic Chicago's Deadly Streets. Bob Chirito, who's a very talented reporter in this town, and I could not think more highly of this book. We love it, right, Bob?
Yeah.
If we were Siskel and Ebert of literature, we'd give it two thumbs up, right?
For sure.
Thank you, guys.
And initially, I was a little skeptical. I thought,
Well, you're skeptical of most everything first, yeah, as every good reporter should be.
Well, because, you know, a lot of the stories are in the book are relatively well-known, but John did a great job at uncovering new things or overlooked things, I should say, probably, and educated me a ton. And I thought I was pretty.
You like the butcher story, right?
Yeah,
that guy's name,
August Becker.
Yeah. What's that story? If that's one of your favorites.
Tommy O'Connor was my favorite because.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
He's the
inspiration for the front page.
Sure. And I should let John say what it's about.
Yeah, well, Tommy O'Connor, he inspired the front page. He was he was kind of a bandit in the city. He had gotten away with a couple murders, and then finally he got cornered by the police, and there was a shootout. He killed one of the police officers who tried to confront him, and it was a little mysterious about how he actually got away because he was supposedly surrounded, but he managed to steal a car and get away. And they eluded the police for months, and they found him finally. I believe it was in St. Paul.
Yeah.
Brought him to trial, and I think I remember the Daily News writing something about his conviction for the police officer's murders. His luck had finally run out. And what would actually happen was in December that year, just a couple days before he was supposed to hang, he busted out of the Cook County Jail. It was one of the greatest jailbreaks in Chicago history, him and a couple other people. And again, he stole a car. He stole a couple of cars and finally made his way northwest out of the city and disappeared. But of course, he had been sentenced to hang. And the Cook County actually held on to the gallows for decades, just in case he was ever found. They even moved.
Classic Cook County.
Right.
Classic Cook County. What do you still have those gallows for? We may find him. The way you handled, and, you know, some publishers, and I know they've been sniffing around other writers in this town to kind of talk about the violence that goes on in Chicago now. And use that and try to make some kind of historical thread. Hmm. It doesn't work for me, John. You cover federal courts. Bob, you cover a lot of current crime in this town. It's a different world.
Yeah, it's not quite the same.
I think it's easy to kind of almost romanticize. You can literally romanticize the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, can't you?
No, you can, and you know, the way that the Daily News wrote about it. I mean, it was really stunning, but yeah, I mean, of course, there's that whole era, right, of mobsters and gangsters, and really has been romanticized.
Yeah,
well, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, there weren't any random 9-year-olds getting hit by a straight bullet back then. And of course, you know, you had the Aaron's case where he did kill kids, but that was not really romanticized. No. I think you're talking more about the gangster stuff.
Yeah, of course.
You know, there was no hits on Tyshawn Lee or
stuff. They wanted the book to end at a sort of far remove, correct? I mean, why was the publisher did not want to dip into 70s, 80s, 90s?
Right. I think things that still could be, where there could still be, just things still happening, you know? I think they wanted the case to be closed. And as it is with Richard Speck, I mean, that one.
Now, did rereading and dipping back into the Speck horrors, what was that like for you?
And Speck was one of the tough ones.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, I did go down to the Illinois State Archives and pull the file on his case and read the blow-by-blow, which, you know, I used to write the chapter about what happened in that townhome. And it's really difficult. And I'd say, yeah, the last couple chapters, it gets pretty difficult because, I mean, he just kind of came out of nowhere and took these women. It was just so savage. I think the savageness of it.
Yeah, I agree. He just was a savage guy. And then even the later years, you want to see, I'm thinking today where these five people were shot to death on, in the Northwest side, that it's all around us now. It's too frequent. And I think one of the reasons Speck chilled me as a young teenager and everybody I know and haunted us forever was it we weren't used to it. What do you think about that, Bob?
Yeah, and I think what really stood out to me was the how courageous the surviving nurse was. I think most people probably don't even know that not every person was killed by Speck that was in that townhouse. And she had to stand up and ID him in court.
Corazon Amaro, I think.
What's that?
Correct.
I think that was her name. Corazon, a name that is literally etched in my brain somehow.
No, she was, it was incredible what she had to go through and then what she did. Just confront him face to face.
You end, the book ends, it's haunting to me. Yeah, your epilogue is a very nicely done epilogue,
too.
You write, you end with the words written by Bill Newman. The Chicago Daily News, a writer's newspaper, ends as it began, a momentous book of life. It took 102 years to finish, and these are the final pages. But the story isn't over, just the Daily News is part of it. A newspaper dies, but newspapering goes on. Life goes on. Tomorrow is the sequel and all the tomorrows after that. That warms the heart of the three of us in here, certainly, who are all newspaper men. And one of the hallmarks of John Seidel's book, Second City Sinners, True Crime from Historic Chicago's Deadly Streets, is that it does give you a sense of newspapering in the eras and the decades that you have covered. Did it give you, John, a new appreciation at all of either the bloody history of this city or the rakish way that reporters often covered the crime?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it certainly did give me a new appreciation. It made me think a lot. You know, I mean, we've covered some big things. While I was writing this book, I covered the Jason Van Dyke trial, which was a big deal last year. And just a brand new context for everything we do, everything we talk about, and how we always try and we try and put things in context. And sometimes we'll say this is the most gruesome, this or the worst, that, and just to be able to think back to some of the things that have happened in this town and how it compares and the parallels and everything. Absolutely, I spent a lot of time thinking.
Well, I think this book gives a really good sound historical perspective to life today, frankly. I do. I don't mean to make too much of it and try to get it on the reading list of every philosophy class in every university in the country. But and Bob, you're a hard guy. I mean, you work. You're a diligent reporter, and you wouldn't fall for nonsense. And you certainly like this book. What do you like about it the most? I mean, is it what I'm saying about it, this historical perspective and a sort of palpable sense of John's excitement of reliving these things and pulling new kinds of research?
I did feel the excitement that he had. that's what I believed he had. And I like the focus on a lot of details that people kind of forget about. Everyone knows that Speck killed eight nurses, but they don't know all the other intricacies. Same with Capone. I mean, you didn't just... You know, he's such a huge topic, but he, and I kind of forgot that he pled guilty to the tax evasion case.
Right, and then the judge had to let him take it back.
Let him take it back, the whole controversy.
Then, right. No, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I did. It was exciting to go back and read through all
these. You've set the bar very high, John Seidel. Second City Sinners, True Crime from Historic Chicago's Deadly Streets deserves to be. There is a great shelf of great Chicago books, and this one deserves to be up there
with Boss and
Everybody Pays. I like that book, too. Thank you all for listening. Ernie, thanks for engineering. Am I supposed to say that? This is, oh my God, this may be against the rules. Ro, thanks for producing. The news is coming up after a few commercials, and I'll see you next Sunday.